Good afternoon and welcome to the Melbourne Law School. For those of you who don't know me, my name's Caron Beaton-Wells and I'm the Director of Studies in Competition Law here at the Law School and the Director of the Competition Law and Economics Network. I'm really delighted to again see a large and very representative gathering from the competition law and economics community from around the country. We have here, of course, amongst us, practitioners, economists, ACCC staff, people from the business sector, and, of course, people from academia and from our student body here in the law school from both our Juris Doctor and our Master's programs. As you'd know, this public lecture theatre series is named in honour of Emeritus Professor Bob Baxt, in recognition of his long and distinguished contribution to competition law in this country. In previous years, it would be Bob and Ruth and various members of his family, down to the littlest ones with their drawing pads populating the front row. And I'm very sorry that they are unable to join us today as Bob is overseas. But you will find in your materials at your seat a personal message from him to you today, and I know that he's very much with us in spirit. I'd also like to acknowledge the generous sponsorship of this year's lecture by Jones Day. Jones Day, of course, a global law firm with a dedicated antitrust practice that spans 27 major cities around the world and involves more than 150 practitioners. We are thrilled that Jones Day has such an interest in partnering with the competition law program here at the law school, and I'll extend a particular welcome and thanks to its representative, Nick Taylor, who has facilitated the firm's support of today's event. While I'm saying thank yous, I'd like to thank also Alan Fells again for his ongoing encouragement and active support of this lecture series and so many aspects of our program in the field here at the law school. To add to his numerous titles and accolades, Alan was appointed an honorary professorial fellow of the law school last year. Before I introduce our distinguished speaker today, I'd like to just take a few moments to say something about our master's program in competition and consumer law, a program that is unrivaled in its scope and depth in the Asia-Pacific region. This is a specialty that has grown enormously since its inception in 2008. Over the last 5 years, it's attracted more than 500 subject enrolments. We offer at least 8 subjects per year, and they are taught by leading experts from around the country and the world. In just the last 2 years, our students have had the privilege of learning from luminaries like Bill Kovacic from Washington, Michael Gall from Haifa, George Hay from Cornell, Karen Jung from King's College, Michael Jacobs from Chicago, Danny Sokol from Florida, amongst others. But there are two particular features I want to draw to your attention today about the program. The first is its interdisciplinarity. Just as Professor Maureen Brunt, who joins us again today, exhorted us so many years ago to bring the economics into the courtroom in competition law cases, so we try and bring the economics into the classroom in our competition law program. All of our students are exposed to the economics of the law in this field. They are taught by economists as well as lawyers, and the curriculum embodies economic principles and methods. And what many people don't actually appreciate is that a considerable proportion of our students are with economics backgrounds rather than law degrees in their background. No more is this exemplified than by our first graduate of the Master of Competition and Consumer Law, Danielle Wood, who is also profiled in the materials before you today. Danielle is a former economist from the ACCC and is now working in public policy at the Grattan Institute, and she shares with you there in her profile the benefits she found of being in a mixed law and economics classroom. The other feature of the program I just want to touch on is its increasing recognition amongst and value to the large and growing number of staff in competition authorities in the new and young regimes around this region. And I'm thrilled to see the law school showing a capacity to contribute to the building of those new competition authorities through the training of its staff. We have about 10% of our students in the program from around the world, from places like Indonesia, Vietnam, China, India, Bangladesh, and also a large number from South America, from Chile and Ecuador. And today, if I don't embarrass them, we do in fact have two officials from the Papua New Guinea Competition Authority with us. They are master's students in the program, and they too are profiled in your materials. But on to the official proceeding. Now, as you know, fittingly, this lecture has been given in previous years by international figures like Bill Kovacic, Richard Wish, and John Fingleton. And today we're no less privileged to hear from Frédéric Jeuny, another towering figure in the global world of competition policy and law. Professor Jeuny is himself an economist of the ESSEC Business School in Paris and a former judge, as I understand it, the only ever economist to be a judge on the Supreme Court of France. He will be known to many of you, though, as the chairman of the OECD Competition Law and Competition and Policy Committee, and he has held that position since 1994. His qualifications, publications, and expertise are indicated to you there in the flyer, and there can be no one perhaps better placed to speak to us with the vast benefit of his experience of consulting to and advising around the world competition authorities on their institutional design, as well as their many other aspects. The institutional design of competition authorities has become, as Professor Jeuny will point out, a very central topic in the minds of competition policy makers, bureaucrats, and of course authority officials themselves in recent years. As Bill Kovacic himself said, brilliant theory without skillful implementation is a bad match. Great ideas from economics, law, or other disciplines require equally great implementing institutions to move a system forward. We'll hear from Professor Jeuny first, and then there will be a brief commentary on the lecture from Nick Taylor, leaving hopefully some time for questions and comments from you. I know the matters that will be canvassed today have been in the minds of many in the Australian competition law community, given the recommendations of the Harper Review in this area. Nick, prior to joining Jones Day, was a partner in a leading Australian law firm, and he also worked with the OECD for several years as its representative in its collaboration with the Korean government. During that time, he had lots of interaction with competition authorities around the world, particularly in the Asia-Pacific region. He's also worked for the ACCC and prior to that, the Industry Commission, which is now the Productivity Commission. So that's enough for me, more than enough, if I could hand over now to Professor Jeuny.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much, Karen. I want to particularly thank you and Jones Day and the University of Melbourne for making this possible. I'm going to talk about institutional design of competition authorities. Part of what I'm going to say is based on a first round of discussion we had at OECD on this topic last December in the competition committee. I understand that the issue of institutional design is of some relevance to Australia, so I'm not going to particularly address the situation in Australia. Maybe when we have questions, we can do that. But I'm going to try to talk about the general trend of ideas throughout the world on this issue. How do I work this? Okay. Oops. Yeah. Historically, it's a topic which has not been frequently addressed by competition authorities. And as a matter of fact, when I was referring to the debate in the OECD last December, this was the first time that we talked at the OECD Competition Committee about institutional design and had an extended discussion. And the members were so worried about what this discussion could lead to that they only accepted to talk about changes that they had done to their institutional designs rather than having the general discussion about what would be an optimal design. But there was quite a bit of information that came out of this. Now, even though it has been a topic which has not been much discussed in the past, recently, the issue of institutional design has come very much to the fore. And I think there are a number of reasons why this has been true. I think that first, economic theory has, with people like Acemoglu and Robinson on Why Nations Fail, and after that, a whole strand of, literature along those lines, has given more importance to governance issues and to the ideas that the way in which you structure systems will lead to different outcomes. And so there is more and more interest on the part of economists to get into those kind of issues. I think there's a second dimension of economic analysis that leads us to become more interested in institutional design, which is the increasing importance of behavioral economics in relationship with competition law. That behavioral economics has been around, as you know, for a long time, but clearly after the financial crisis has become more important and has clearly brought to the fore the idea that the context in which people make decisions may have an impact on the outcome of the decisions that they make, and therefore this also brings the idea that maybe the institutional design of competition authorities or other institutional design may be irrelevant to explain the performances of agencies or the way in which people behave. The third dimension, I think, has to do with the success of competition authorities over the last two decades. The fact that they have become quite established in a number of jurisdictions. They've started imposing very heavy sanctions that were sometimes described as criminal in nature, even if they were not legally criminal. And this has led to a lot of people asking or wanting to know more about the effectiveness of those authorities and the worst of the work that they were doing. A fourth reason, I think, has to do with globalization. As the globalization has developed and has competition law. Oops, sorry, this is going ahead of me. So I don't know how one goes. Okay. Yes. As a number of countries have decided to have a competition authorities, they have. Sorry. Is it when I touch this? Yeah, that's what happened. Okay. Sorry. As the greater number of countries have adopted a competition law, of course, there has been a more and more of a request by a number of countries that were in the process of establishing a competition authority to ask for advice on how to do it. I must say that up to this point, the OECD, for example, has no advice on how to set up a competition authority, because the issue of how you set up a competition authority has never been studied very extensively. Okay, and finally, of course, there are also some concerns about some rising jurisdictions. I mean, have China in my mind in particular, and the idea that maybe the outcome of the enforcement of competition policy and law in China has to do with the institutional design of the institutions there, and because China is such an important player, this has raised a new interest in looking at the relationship between institutional design and performance of authorities. So there are a number of reasons which have pushed the international community into looking more precisely at those issues than used to be the case. And there are a number of dimensions which have been discussed. And they are on the slides here. What should be the goals of competition authority? what should be the types of competition authority, what should be the functions that the competition authority has, what should be the organizational structure and the working methods of competition authorities, what is the status of competition authority, and finally, what are the instruments that competition authorities should use or not use. I'm going to touch rapidly on each one of those points, but I want to say right at the beginning that you're going to be disappointed if you expect me to say that there's one way to do things better than another. You're going to be thoroughly disappointed. When one looks across the world, one sees, first of all, there's a huge variety of institutional designs. When you ask competition authority, they're always satisfied that their institutional design is the best possible and should be changed. And once it has been changed, they are absolutely adamant that this change was for the better, whatever it was. There's no necessary consistency across time along some of those dimensions, not all of them. Along some of those dimensions, we see that over time, competition authorities change their institutional design. In other words, that it's an evolutionary process. I think that the end result of this is that there is no one-size-fits-all, but there are lots of trade-offs. And what the discussion has brought to the fore are, on many of those dimensions, what the trade-offs are. The way those trade-offs play in different countries or in different jurisdictions are different because of the legal system, because of the history, because of the politics, which may account for the fact that we have different results. So what I'm mostly going to try to do is to talk about the trade-offs. Irrespective of the fact that there is no unique model, there are trends on several of those dimensions, and I will also mention what the trends are as we go along. So first, if I turn to the goals of competition authorities, I think that there is a growing consensus, I would say, at least in the competition community and among competition authorities, that consumer surplus should be, the protection of consumer surplus should be the overriding goal of competition law. As an economist, I've always not been completely convinced by this. I've always had in my mind the fact that maybe a total welfare approach would be more desirable. It is true that with globalization, and if you think about the fact that there is a possibility that the benefits of competition do not show up in the same places as the cost of competition, total welfare may become more complicated as an ultimate test or goal of competition law. Notwithstanding the fact that this is the consensus, the reality is quite different from the consensus. The reality is that at least half of the competition authorities throughout the world have other goals besides consumer protection. This is true of developed as well as of developing countries. And within the countries that have other approaches, there are those who say, well, consumer surplus, yes, but there are also other goals that should be pursued. Within the category of those that think that there could be other goals, there's the question of whether those other goals should be economic goals or whether they could also be public interest goals. And we have a wide variety of situation along those lines. That's unexpected. Yeah. Economic goals, meaning by these goals that go beyond consumer surplus. Well, Australia is an obvious case. But besides Australia, there are plenty of jurisdictions that have had competition law for a long time. Norway, New Zealand, Swaziland, Kenya are all aligned on a total welfare goal. Now, there are a number of countries, developed or developing, which have a broader economic agenda than consumer surplus. Germany tries to protect competition for its own sake as an effective process. Hungary is closer to a total welfare so is Iceland. Ireland tries to ensure the competitiveness of the Irish economy, which is not too far from what Canada is trying to achieve. Switzerland wants to prevent the harmful economic or social effects of cartels. So we see that the goals that are assigned to competition law, in fact, are quite varied, even within the general category of economic goals. Plus, a number of competition authorities have, or competition laws, have socio-political goals that are very wide in design, the promotion of employment, regional development, national champion, national ownership, economic stability, social progress, poverty alleviation, spread of ownership, security interest, national interest, etc. So those are the socio-political goals. Now, if you look, for example, at the competition law of China, as I'm sure you have, you will see that they are, the idea is that the Chinese competition law should help the development of the socialist economy as well as promoting the welfare of people. And also, if you look at South Africa, it's the promotion of the people who have been disenfranchised, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the main question, really, that I want to address is, why is it, what are the arguments that say that competition authorities should be focused on consumer surplus as a goal? And I think that the arguments which are given in favor of this very narrow goal, which, by the way, is a political disaster because it's very hard when you have a consumer surplus as a goal to explain to the wider community that you don't have a very narrowly focused, that you don't care about employment, you don't care about the welfare of firms, you just care about the welfare of consumers, and that does create a bit of difficulty for competition authorities. But beyond that, what are the arguments which are usually given in favor of such a narrow approach to competition? Well, the first one is that it would be too difficult for competition authorities to do the balance between the possible efficiencies coming out of the anti-competitive practices and the benefits from the anti-competitive practices. I find that a very unconvincing argument because it's basically saying, you know, if I lose my key and it's in the dark, I'm only going to look where there's light because elsewhere it's too dark. The fact that it may be difficult to do doesn't mean that you should not do it if that gives you the right answer. Or put it in another way, you may have huge costs by not doing it. Okay, so this is not a very rational answer. There's a second argument which is given in favor of the narrow interpretation of the goals, which is the fact that non-competition policy mechanisms are generally superior for achieving non-competition policy objectives, and that therefore restricting competition in order to achieve a broader policy objective, whether economic or not, is not very wise. Again, I'm not personally entirely convinced that this is a very good argument. The question really, if there are non-political goals which society wants to achieve, non-consumer surplus goal that society wants to achieve, the real question is whether the competition authority is going to do a better job at achieving those goals. And by a better job, I mean a job that is going to be less destructive of competition than if it's someone else who is achieving those goals. For example, a dedicated agency that is trying to promote employment, for example. Is that dedicated agency going to promote employment in a way which is going to be more destructive of competition than the competition authorities would have done it? And the third one is that the policy objectives can be ambiguous and subject to capture or hijack, and that therefore public interest objectives may in fact serve private interests. Fine, but I've always heard that competition authorities are least likely to be captured and that other regulators are more likely to be captured. So that would be an argument to giving those objectives to the competition authority rather than narrowing the objectives of the competition law and the objectives that the competition authority should follow. So it seems to me that in that discussion, the problem is what is the counterfactual? If the counterfactual is that all of those other goals would not exist if the competition authority did not deal with them, that's fine. If the counterfactual is that the choice is between having the competition authority deal with those factors or having another agency not under the control of the competition authority deal with them, then there is a real question about where should those goals be fulfilled. But I don't find that there is a very good argument in favor of having only a narrow goal for competition authorities. Models of enforcement. The trend for a first in the world is the fact that the administrative model, as opposed to the judicial model or the judicial model, has gained ground in the world. One big part of it, of course, is the fact that in many developing jurisdictions, the judiciary is not only weak, but also overburdened and not very knowledgeable about economic issues, and that it seems a better bet to try to give the enforcement of the competition law to an administrative body. Now, there are pros and cons of the judicial model in this case. Clearly, one of the pros of a judicial model is that the due process will be usually better protected, particularly because in most administrative systems, the administrative body acts simultaneously as the investigator, the adjudicator, and has many functions which are not always very well separated. The second argument in favor of the judicial model, of course, is that it avoids the confirmation bias that one could find when the same agency first investigates and then adjudicates the case. The third argument is that in the judicial process, the transparency of the process is usually more pronounced than in administrative models, where it's very hard to know who makes the decision. For 8 years, I was on the board of the UFT. I must say that after 8 years, I still wasn't quite sure who made the decisions in the UFT. I mean, ultimately, it was the CEO of the UFT, but exactly who was talking. And this was a permanent criticism of the system, that you could never find a decision maker because it was kind of a bunch of people who were supposed to be decision makers, but you didn't know which level it was. An argument which is sometimes alleged is that if it's a judicial system and if it's a court that makes the determination on the violation, it's likely that there will be fewer appeals. I'm not convinced that this is the case. That assumes, of course, that there is some kind of distrust of the competition authority if it's an administrative body and therefore people rush to court whatever the competition authority has said. But I've not seen empirical evidence that there are fewer incidents of appeals against court decisions than there are against administrative decisions. On the challenge or on the con side, of course, the fact that one of the possible advantages of an administrative system is that you could have a specialized body where you would have both legal and economic, people with legal and economic backgrounds, and therefore a wide variety of expertise. Second, the fact that it is possible that, it is possible that the length of the proceedings may be much shorter in an administrative body, which is sometimes true. When you look at the Google case, it's not entirely obvious that this is always the case. That cases may not be so attractive to judges and competent cases. Indeed, in many jurisdictions, competent cases have the reputation of being long, complicated, requiring a lot of evidence, which is hard to understand, and sometimes the judges are not so keen. I mean, the best judges are not so keen to have those cases. So you may end up with judges which are not necessarily the best in their system. And finally, one thing that should be mentioned is the fact that in administrative systems don't necessarily have to be systems where there is a complete confusion between the various functions of the administrative body. There's a huge trend among competition authorities to clearly separate the adjudication from the investigation, to have the investigators or the staff, the case officers, being appointed independently of the board. So there are ways to make to remedy one of the possible difficulty of administrative systems. Now, as I said, there is a general tendency to have administrative enforcement system in many countries, particularly in developing countries. This is not always true. For example, Egypt has adopted the judicial type of system, prosecutorial system. This issue also was raised in the context of the discussion that took place in the UK, for example, when there was a change between the previous system and the creation of the CMA, whether the system should also change in its nature, whether we should go towards a prosecutorial model and give up the administrative model. Eventually, the administrative model was kept, but there was a discussion. So there are sometimes discussions about changing this model. More important is my third topic, which is the functions of competition authority. The trend there is very different from what I understand the discussion in Australia is all about, because the trend in the world is to have more multifunction authorities and fewer single-function authorities. Now, if I look at the countries which made contributions to the OECD discussion in December, 1, 2, 3, 7 of those were jurisdictions which had recently merged competition law enforcement and consumer protection. Yeah, I'm going to talk first about consumer protection and then about sectoral regulation. So 7 had merged those functions, 3 had separated them, and 4 had considered merging them but opted against merging them, which shows that there's a wide variety of opinion on the wisdom of merging functions. But still, 7 have merged those functions, so that's reasonably important. What are the arguments in favor of merging consumer protection and competition enforcement? The most important argument, I think, comes from the fact that it is quite obvious by now that there are a number of sectors or markets where there is structural competition, there is no particular anti-competitive behavior, and yet competition doesn't work. So it cannot work either because consumers don't know how to make it work or don't want to make it work. If you think about the financial services, for example, this is a clear example of an area where competition doesn't work, which means that the competition authorities, if it's only dealing with the competition side of the issue, the supply side, I would say, of the issue, is unable to actually bring competition to the market because it would require to have other means of acting on consumers, on things that would allow consumers to either better compare the offers or be more mobile across suppliers. So the complementarity between the two, sometimes described as the supply approach and the demand approach, seems to be quite important. And therefore, there is an argument to have a more holistic view of market problems. The second thing is, if you have both the typical competition instruments and on top of this, instruments that come from consumer policy, you can use them in a complementary way and in a flexible way to try to achieve the desired outcome, which is to make the market work for consumers. I must say that on this line, having, as I said, served on the board of the OFT, I have been very impressed by the work which has been done by the economists of the OFT to try to bring together the consumer aspect of things and the competition aspect of things. I think it's been the most, it's probably the agency in the world which has done the most research and used this complementarity the best. that I know of, and I would say that they've probably done a better job than the FTC, for example, in the U.S., where it's, the two branches are more separate. And finally, there's the idea that to the extent that competition authorities also manage the consumer protection, they can avoid some of the consumer protection tendencies to come up with solutions that actually reduce competition rather than promote competition. On the con side, or the drawbacks, the possible drawback, first idea is by doing several things, the competition authority may lose the focus of what it is doing. And there are a number of issues, privacy, product safety, and so on and so forth, where if the competition authority is in charge of this, you may end up not knowing exactly what it is that the agency is trying to promote. Second, for any agency which has several functions, the prioritization of cases may be a bit more complex. And then there is a whole string of arguments, which I don't very much believe in, that if you have two functions, one of them may be under-allocated vis-a-vis the others. And we've had those some people say, well, you know, if you have competition policy and consumer protection, well, all the money is going to go to consumer protection, and they're going to be under enforcement of competition. But you'll have the reverse argument that all the money is going to go to, because it's more sexy and it leads itself to bigger cases, and so therefore it's going to be better for the agency to have to invest its money on competition. Now, if I continue, but look this time internally, one idea, which is an underlying idea for all the jurisdictions which have merged consumer protection and competition, is the savings on cost. You can't necessarily save on cost of cases because they are different technique, but you can save on PR, you can save on the IT, you can save on all kinds of administrative costs, and there are some estimates of how much you can save. Also the fact that you may end up with better quality decisions by having a more holistic view and therefore having a better market intelligence. Whether in some cases this is more controversial, you can pool investigative and litigation expertise between competition cases and consumer protection cases. And finally, the fact that as you have more responsibility, you have an organization which is more, both more important but also has a more ambitious political mandate, and therefore it's easier to recruit and you get better people than you would otherwise. There are, again, counter-arguments. One of the main counter-arguments is when you put together competition people and consumer protection people, you end up having a difficult time reconciling those two communities. Sometimes you give up on it. That would be the case of the US FTC. So you use two separate entrances, and they don't even know that they're in the same building, practically. And sometimes you try to integrate them, but that's not so always easy. Second, that there may be specific cost of the integration. Maybe there are cost savings due to the fact that you can merge some general services, but there are cost of integration. If for no other reason, the fact that maybe the staff don't know as precisely what is expected from them and that therefore you need more monitoring, etc. That the procedural differences between the consumer protection cases and the competition cases may limit the synergies. And by the way, there is the sub-discussion on what kind of consumer protection cases are we looking at. Are we looking at the main general big issues of consumer protection, or are we looking at the small cases at the local level? And it's quite clear that the more you get to the local level, the more difficult it is to mix with the competition agency kind of cases, which are usually nationwide cases. That the sharing of information may require protocols and firewalls to ensure that the procedures are respect the due process, etc. And that some of the efficiencies could probably be had even without a merger of the two functions. Finally, externally, when the competition authority talks to the rest of the world, some people would argue that being both the Consumer Protection Agency and the competition agency will allow the agency to be more visible, to get greater political support from consumers, and allow people who are unhappy with the market or economic market to have just one-stop shop. On the other side, you have an equally number of people who say, well, having two voices is sometimes better than one, that spurious consumer protection defense may end up in competition cases, thus biasing competition cases, or that there may be a perception that the authority is becoming too important, dealing with too many problems, overreaching, and that leads to some political backlash, so to speak. What's amusing is to look at the countries which have separated functions. There are two countries, Japan and Iceland, have separated the consumer protection function. Iceland separated the two functions to improve on its competition enforcement. Japan separated the two functions to improve on its consumer protection enforcement. So, I mean, here I'm not going to go into this, but you have the quotes of the two agencies. Okay, now if we move to the second level, which is competition and sectoral regulation, we have different types of model. There's the Australian model, the UK model, and the, I would say, the continental European model. The UK model would be, you know, the regulators have at least some concurring powers or sometimes some exclusive power to deal with competition in their sectors. The European model would be a division of labor between institutions that communicate with each other but have very specific and separate mandates. If we look at what's happened recently, again, basing ourselves on this OECD the contribution that the OECD debate, we see that quite a number of jurisdictions have merged the competition authority with one or the other sectoral regulator. This is true of Denmark with the water regulator, Estonia with the energy, rail and telecom regulator, Netherlands with the telecom and post regulator, Spain with the airport, audiovisual, energy, rail, post and telecom, and Lithuania with the rail. So there is a tendency towards having more multifunction agencies there. But some have separated the functions about the same time, Denmark, Estonia, and Mexico, for example. What are the trade-offs there? Some of the trade-offs are the same that as the trade-offs that we talked about when we talked about joining up consumer protection and competition. There are some new ones. The first one is a new one. The idea there is that a sectoral regulator always deal with the same powerful firms, while the ex-incumbent have a lot of political clout, and that in the end, the sectoral regulator may end up being captured by it. On the opposite side, the competition authority has many clients in many different sectors and is less prone to being captured by its clients. Then after that, we have arguments that we've already seen, more flexible range of tools. If you deal with an issue in a sector, I mean, and you're both the regulator of the sector and looking at competition issues in the sector, you may use either regulatory tools or competition authority tools, better able to detect conflicts between the two approaches, and the pooling of information and responsibility may make the agency more adaptable in the cases of changing markets or markets that change rapidly. On the con side, we find again the problem of conflicting objectives. I mean, and how do you set priorities? The fact that there are two different philosophies of intervention, there's a kind of an ex ante and ex post, and that getting those two cultures together may not be very easy, may lead to a loss of focus of the authority. That the authority may have to have different governance or decision-making processes depending on the kind of decision it has, and it becomes a very untransparent and hard-to-read institution. On the internal size, cost savings again, that is one, possibly the most important determinant for all the jurisdictions which have merged sectoral regulators with competition authorities recently. The idea of governments or the idea of parliaments was that there would be some cost saving there, and I will come back to this in a minute, that there are complementary expertise, and that, again, the wider the scope of the agency, the easier it is to recruit high-quality people and, therefore, to increase the quality of the agency. On the other side, culture clash. I mean, this, every regulators that talked, every competition authorities who talked during this debate, having both responsibility, talked about the difficulty of getting the culture, the sectoral culture, the regulatory culture, and the competition culture together. And so that seems to be a real problem. There can be integration costs. Substantial and procedural differences that may limit the benefit of the merger. Concerns about sharing the information when you go from one activity to the other in the same sector. And again, the fact that some of the efficiency could possibly be obtained without merging the functions. There are strong reservations in some country about moving in that direction. For example, Italy made a statement saying, well, in my country, the competition authority doesn't deal with sectoral regulation, and we absolutely do not want the government to think that we might be given responsibility to deal with sectoral regulation, because that would we would lose our independence. That's basically the argument of the Italian. Now, Italy is a place where competition authority does so many things that even the ACCC would be jealous of and Italy is, but this is another issue that I will come to. The attempt by government just to dump more and more activity on the competition authority just because they are there and they seem to be successful. I've got to hurry up. Single commissioner versus board. I'm not going to go through this, but if you're interested, we'll come back to this. Again, there are advantages and disadvantages. Independence. Now, independence is something that we have started to worry about a lot, particularly in the case of Europe, at different levels, because the first question is, how do you define independence? The second is, what are the safeguards? And the third thing is, are the safeguards meaningful? Now, the easiest thing is to define what we mean by independence. We mean that the authority should be able to exercise its mandate as it sees fit, based on economic considerations and legal consideration, without any kind of political interference, forcing the authority either to take cases or to drop cases or to decide in a way which is not the way in which it would want. But there are difficulties. Independence cannot go without accountability. Accountability means that someone is going to overlook what the competition authority is doing. So that someone, maybe parliament, it may be the government, it may be a court, it may be... And the question is, what is the right... I mean, is this accountability getting into the way of the independence of the authority, and what is the right trade-off between the two? Bill Kovacic has great stories about going to the Hill, you know, every other week to explain why it is that they haven't intervened on petroleum and why is it that they won't do it, and being under a constant threat of seeing its budget being reduced. The second issue is between statutory independence and de facto independence. One of the neat things is that whatever criteria or safeguards you design for independence, then you, when you try to apply them, most of the most famous, most respected jurisdiction don't meet those criteria. The DOJ is part of the executive, so that's not so good. The FTC, the chair, is appointed by the president and has to be removed when the president changes, so that's not great. The EC Commission, it's part of the executive, that's not great either. Canada, the competition commissioner, is also part of the executive, so that's not great. An interesting part of the debate was to say, okay, we have a lot of difficulty defining the criteria. When we have the criteria, we see that the competition authorities we believe in as independent don't meet those criteria. And when we look at newer jurisdiction, we don't care whether they meet or not the criteria. We don't believe that they are really independent. So there's a real issue about the relationship between de facto and... This discussion, by the way, was revived by the discussion in the UK, and I know that this is of relevance to Australia, about is it a limitation of the independence of a competition agency to be subjected to a strategic steer given by the executive. The CMA position on this is that it has the best possible world because the UK government can now give a steer to the CMA and at least it's going to do it publicly. So that's an advance compared to a situation where there was no steer, but we didn't know whether there was no implicit or hidden steer. I think that's a weak argument because you can give a public steer, but you could also try to push in a non-official fashion. But okay. A lot of competition authorities say, though, I mean, this argument of publicity of the steer, they say, you know, we're interested in knowing what is the competition policy that the government would like to follow. As long as we are independent and we can do what we want with the steer, we don't object to it. But there's no unanimity. Portugal is a case where they have gone exactly the other way. It used to be that the minister could give a steer to the competition authority. The minister never gave a steer to the competition authority. It never happened. Nevertheless, they have taken it out of the law because they thought that the sheer possibility that the minister could give a steer was in itself an attempt or a limitation on the independence of the competition authority. My last point is on... instruments. This is more a question. What's happened, I think. Let me say just one thing before on independence. One dimension of independence, which has been emphasized by competition authority, is to have enough money, resources. I'm saying, well, you know, if I don't have resources, I cannot be independent, so you've got to give me a lot of money. Now, first, it's always, there's slight principal agent issue when the advocacy for more resources for competition agency comes from competition agencies. But beyond that, one consequence of this has been, in fact, the fact that there's been a tendency to say, okay, we'll give you enough money because the whole community says that you need enough money to be independent, but because you're very costly, you're now going to do a lot of things for us. And this has been one of the forces that has led to a number of sectoral regulators being merged with competition authority by saying, with all this money, you should be able to do this. It has been also the reason why in Italy, whenever there's a new regulation of anything, rather than creating a new regulator, why don't we send it to the Italian authority, because the Italian authority has a very secure mean of being financed. So there are interactions between those criteria. Last thing, the instruments. The trend of the instruments, I would argue, at least in Europe, but also in some other countries, is for competition authorities to become more and more regulatory. In other words, if you look at some of the new instruments, they have some common element. If you look at leniency program, commitment decisions, market studies that can lead to remedies being given. They are great to increase the effectiveness of the agency, either because they reveal all kinds of practices that would have been hard to find, or because they allow to solve the problem more rapidly than if you had a full procedures, or because they give you a very wide view and possibly help you in a very flexible way to intervene. So there's no question about the fact that they increase the effectiveness of competition agency. It's quite clear that at the same time, they reduce the scope of judicial oversight, either because in the case of leniency, there are fewer reasons to appeal because it's so obvious because of the leniency programs that the facts are there, or in the case of commitment decisions because you do not have a decision that recognizes the fact that there was a violation, or in the market studies because you are not in a judicial, a decision-making process of the same kind that you have when you have prohibition decisions. In Europe, in the world in general, we went from a focus in the early 2000s, which was on the extent to which competition law helped efficiency, to another discussion, which is the discussion we have now, whether competition authorities are effective or not. Okay. So all those new instruments increase the effectiveness of competition authority, and they are considered to be very good. Part of it is because no one puts any value on the development of a coherent jurisprudence as a way to increase legal predictability. Now, if you ignore this cost, all this movement seems to be in the right direction. My argument is that it may not be always true. I will just give you an example also of what can happen by comparing the commitment decisions that we have in the European system and in the US system. How this transplant, in the name of effectiveness, has become even more effective because there are even more less safeguards. So in the European case, there are commitment decisions of the EU decisions where they first discuss the remedies and then they discuss what could justify the remedies. Okay, so it's complete reverse engineering. So focus on remedy, that's effective, and then we'll find a reason for the remedies. That was the Coca-Cola case. There's no judicial oversight, unlike in the U.S. In the U.S., at least you have to bring your commitment decision to a judge so that the judge will validate. It's true that in the U.S. there is weak oversight from the judiciary because they use a public interest test, which is very weak. In Europe, there's no such thing. I mean, the commission decides that there's going to be a decision, and that's it. And, of course, whoever gave the commitments cannot appeal the decision because they gave the commitment in the first place. In Europe, there's no the proportionality does not apply the same way in the commitment decision that it applies in the prohibition decisions. In prohibition decision, the commission has to have a fine or has to have an injunction which is proportionate to the violation. The court has said, the Court of Justice has said in the El Rosa judgment, in the commitment decision, you don't have to worry about this because the commitment were offered in the first place. So it's up to the firm, okay? So if the firm offered them, it doesn't make any difference. And the Arosa case was a clear case where the commitment, which were offered by De Beers, went way beyond what was strictly necessary to solve the competition problem. But the court said, but De Beers offered those commitments, so that's the end of the discussion. And finally, there is less transparency. Now, all this is fine for effectiveness of the competition authority, not great for the development of the law, but it's fine. We went, before Mr. Almunia got into power as commissioner, the proportion of commitment decision excluding mergers and cartels, so all for all the verticals or abuse of the dominance, was already pretty high, 68%. It passed to 77% under Mr. Almunia, which is really the vast majority of cases are solved this way. Now, I had a bunch of slides that I took out because I was too long on the Google case to explain to you exactly what can happen in such a case and to show that this was not a good use of commitment decision. Now, I want to be clear on this. I think commitment decision can be very useful for repetitive cases where there's already case law. It's very clear. And in that case, going through the full case, incurring costs, which are unnecessary because everybody knows what the outcome is going to be, is probably useless. In the Google case, which is clearly a market which has not been studied and the set of issues which are new, there's absolutely no reason to do a commitment decision in the name of effectiveness. So my last word was there's this huge tendency towards more effectiveness of competition authorities to the detriment sometimes of the development of the law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Fred, for that. That was a fantastic rundown. Just a few things. To begin with, thank you very much to the Melbourne Law School. Really, the Melbourne Law School is a fantastic program. The faculty are all really leading lights in the Australian community, competition law community. So we're very proud to be associated with this event. Then a couple of words about the OECD, since we're about to have the ICN and we're talking about institutional design. If you haven't had a look at the OECD's papers and the work that has been done really under Fred's presidency, the OECD has many committees on many things. This is one of the most active, probably, you know, arguably the most active, and it produces enormous quantities of very useful material that summarises what goes on right around the world on a whole range of issues. A difference between the OECD and the ICN, there are a couple of them, and that they're relevant to this topic that we've been talking to today. The ICN is an international organisation of competition authorities, whereas the OECD is an international organisation of governments. Often they send their competition authorities as the representatives, but they are actually the governments, so they can have a broader institutional focus. So I think it's a very good topic for the OECD to handle. So with those couple of sort of introductory things, I won't try and sort of commentate on all of the speech by any means, but just a few thoughts before your questions. The first one I thought I'd touch on is industry regulation versus competition regulation. Having seen transatlantic discussions about this issue, I think there's a couple of points that the Fred's members have sort of glossed over. And one is that I think the transatlantic authorities are very fearful of the kind of model that we have here, partly because they haven't tried it yet. So they're fearful when they look at things like excessive pricing in Europe and say, how are we going to get the data to do our cases? What are we going to do in terms of remedies? We don't have the skills. Those sorts of things are also part of their thinking about it. It's certainly relevant that that there are two different philosophies of these two agencies, but I think if you put the philosophies in a hierarchy and you say what we would want is competition in all markets first, and it's only where that fails we move to a sectoral model, it's actually potentially a good thing to have the two in the one agency, because you can have your sectoral regulation trying to push as much as possible back into a competitive market situation. So so that's a couple of points on that interaction. The second is that in institutional design, and Fred spoke of the two models, the administrative model or the court enforcement model, and there are many pros and cons, but there's also constraints. And, for instance, constitutional constraints are important in the model. Obviously, in Australia, if we're going to have fines come out of the end of a case, it's very difficult under our constitution to have it in an administrative model. So there are constraints that we are under and that some other countries are under. But there's also some constraints that the Australian system is not under. So, for instance, there is not, for example, in Europe, a necessity to engage with human rights law, which does affect competition law administration quite heavily in Europe, from everything, how you do a Dawn raid, recent French cases, those sorts of things. So there are some constraints that we don't have. And one of the things that has produced, in my observation, is a civil penalty regime for individuals. So there are actually a lot of different models that we can study about how to do things. And some of those come out of legal constraints, and after all, we're at the law school. So I thought I'd throw in that idea in the different model discussion. The last thing is to touch on funding. I mean, right around the world, austerity is sort of one of the biggest public policy sort of objectives at the moment, and of course that's affecting competition authorities. And I think, you know, to think about how this fits in, what you're designing in a competition enforcement regime is deterrence, what you're hoping to deter anti-competitive conduct. And so there are quite a few interlinked elements to this. And funding affects things like detection, how much investigation can be done, case selection, whether you've got the means to prove your cases. But then that's interlinked with all sorts of other things. The size of the penalties also affect deterrence. So this funding issue and having austerity, which we've experienced in Australia, but we're experiencing right around the world, will affect the private, business actors' decisions about in response to sort of the effective level of deterrence. It also, I think, funding affects institutions and the incentives that are upon them in terms of, for example, case selection. If you have three relatively inexpensive, say, consumer protection cases that you're weighing up in a limited resource environment against a very expensive competition case, that can be sort of interesting in terms of what functions are put within the one agency when you bring austerity into the mix, and also that agency's effect on case selection for the next round of funding. So if some quick decisions can be delivered by the courts of a popular nature that are inexpensive to run, there's a tendency, I suggest, that you might cloud your judgment about which case you might run. So I think austerity sort of mixes in with the institutional design in quite a lot of sort of ways. So there are a few sort of thoughts that I had sort of in response to Fred's talk, and no doubt many others will. So we'll hand over to questions.
Thanks, Steve. I've got a bit of time, so I might open up to the floor and ask if there are any questions or just comments.
I found those comments really fascinating, Fred, and I was actually fortunate enough to be at the session. Your observation about independence was very interesting, and it was one that I think you made at the time in Paris, and I think Pastor might have also said something similar. The observation that the agencies that we respect as independent don't necessarily have an institutional framework which you would regard as necessarily supporting that independence. I thought about that quite a bit afterwards, and I thought it was a bit like integrity. Agencies develop a reputation for independence and integrity because of the way that they behave, because of the cultures that are developed, which are sometimes supported by an institutional framework and the structures around them. And it's great if those things are there, but often often the most important thing is the way people actually behave, the culture that has developed in the agency. And so I'm interested in your comments on that.
You're absolutely right that one of the outcome of the discussion on independence that we had was the fact that since the de jure safeguards are not necessarily sufficient to ensure independence, in fact, what we are talking about is the fact that independence is building up over time. It is the result of a long practice which is considered to be reasonable and independent, and that's when So in some sense, it is something that is earned by the institution through its behavior. And I think that this is what BIAC, because I was implicitly referring to a contribution by BIAC. BIAC made the observation, said, okay, I take the World Bank criteria that apply to all of you around the table. Not one of you meets those criteria. Nevertheless, there are institutions that I believe in and institutions I'm not sure I believe in. Now, it is true that the institutions that BIAC wasn't sure it believed in were the newer institution, and this led to another bias. For example, China was not to be believed, but it wasn't clear that it was because it was less independent, or it wasn't clear because it was because the Chinese law has some public interest clauses, and that the MOFCOM and the other agencies actually apply those clauses because those provisions because they are part of the law. So I think that in that process there is some time for agencies which are new. A more difficult threshold because the sheer fact that they're new, they haven't had time to develop a reputation, and therefore they are not trusted to the same extent. But you're quite right that in the end one can recognize an independent institution even if one cannot define it very precisely. I'm not. First of all, I'm not sure what you mean by evaluate. You mean evaluate in terms of measurement, or well, I don't know that I have an answer, a good answer to you. I'm very sensitive to this issue, because what happened to me, as Karen said, I was an economist and I've worked on the margin of economics and law for a long time, and then I became a judge, and all of a sudden my way of speaking and my way of thinking changed. So it was goodbye to deterrence. Proportionality, yes, deterrence. So there was a change. Another change was a theory of harm, unknown. Facts, yes, facts. One of the issues was the fact that the judges were very conservative, and so they would follow their jurisprudence. And even when you could prove to them that the jurisprudence was economically didn't make sense, first of all, it was difficult to convince them, but eventually you did it. And then the natural reaction was, but is this the right case to change our jurisprudence? This is an obvious case, it's a simple case, it's clear that you heard. Okay. But through repetition of this process, which I lived through, I realized that what they had in mind was the fact that the objective is not uniquely to be right, but the objective is to give a steer that people can understand and that they can follow. So therefore, there's a cost of changing, even if reality is very complex, there's a cost of changing your jurisprudence too often, because that makes people confused, and they don't use the law as a beacon of what they should do or what they shouldn't do. Now, I've never seen any economic study try to put a value dimension to this, but it's clear to me that if the law and the jurisprudence has any meaning, it is to help people decide what is good, particularly in an area like competition or antitrust, and particularly for the kind of rule of reason approach cases. So it seems to me that the onus is more on the economists in this case, because they've ignored one function of the law, which is to ensure some kind of predictability, and therefore for which some kind of stability may be a positive, not the only value, because being correct is certainly another value, but there's a trade-off there. And now, if you tell me that I've seen studies that try to put down, okay, what is exactly the cost of changing of jurisprudence today as opposed to changing it later on after an accumulation of cases, I haven't seen those studies. I would like to see them because they are... Now, it seems to me that in the competition world, there are a lot of assumptions of that type or things which have not been proved by empirical evidence, which we assert all the time. If I think about the idea that leniency programs have to be defended at all costs and private enforcement should not get into the way of leniency program, so there should be very restrictive rules on the kind of information that can be used. Okay. It seems to me that private enforcement in itself also has a deterrent effect. Leniency certainly has a deterrent effect. So the question is to measure the net benefit or the net cost of having a leniency program that limits private enforcement or more private enforcement, which makes the leniency program weaker because people are less insensitive. No economic studies, no studies by competition authority, just an assumption, which I understand, because the leniency program also has a private benefit for them. You know, you sit in your chair and you wait for the evidence to come, so that's good irrespective of anything else. But again, that's an era where measurement of effects would have been useful to, because there are trade-offs. Now, on the first point, I completely agree with you that there has been a rising interest in the benefits of rule of law. That's why I quoted Acemoglu and Robinson, because they were, you know, on why nations fail. They were among the first one at the macroeconomic level. What I haven't seen is at the microeconomic levels, the same kind of studies. In other words, it's one thing to say countries that have a poor governance, poor institutions, and no rule of law are not doing as well as the others. So this is the macro part. But the micro part, I think, is yet to be developed. I mean, the kind of evaluation that we were talking about. Now, on the second question, my concern with the commitment decisions in particular is that the procedural framework of those commitment decisions, at least in Europe and in a number of other countries, is not strict enough so that the decisions can lead to completely unpredictable results on anything. For example, I would be completely satisfied if we had in Europe a system of commitment decisions that was preceded by a notification of, a standard of objection, okay? Because then the authority would have laid out its case and say, okay, I think I have this case, and this is the case that I want to pursue. And then it's up to the firm to decide, whether it wants to fight this case or not. We don't have this. What we have is competition concerns. Well, I'm concerned all the time, and sometimes I'm right to be concerned, and sometimes I'm not right to be concerned. Okay, and it's exactly the same thing for now, in those cases, and I have quotes in this deck. I'm not going to go back to the deck. Mr. Almunia saying, what I want is remedies. I don't want to think about why I want remedies. I want remedies. Okay, so let's go and have remedies. In those cases, there's a very high probability that there might be mistakes being made. And to be honest, if I look at the Google case, I have no particular idea on the Google case, but I'm personally quite satisfied that Ms. Vestager has decided to go the standard of objection way, because at least the commission will lay out its case and Google will answer what it can answer, and they will, in a transparent way, they will decide which way it's going to be. I think that the usefulness of the procedures is that it is a mechanism to try to limit the errors, the possible errors of the system. If you forget the procedures or if you have insufficient procedures, then you increase the error rate. So it may make the sectoral regulators... Now, a lot of sectoral regulators make decisions after a very precise procedural set of steps. What I was talking about was not that. I'm talking about ways to bypass. To be honest, the success of the commitment decisions is manifold. A, you don't have to worry about proportionality. That's the first thing. Okay, so that's hugely debatable as, whether it's a good thing. The second one, there's not going to be an appeal. Okay? So no court review. So forget the courts. So those two things lead competition authorities to be very tempted by those instruments. I'm not saying that they are not useful, but there has to be a minimum standard of what is a competition concern. And it cannot be, oh, I'm concerned. Come and talk to me and offer me remedies, and we'll see whether I like them.
Can I just ask you, Fred, on the question of functions of the competition authority, we've been looking in the context of the Harper reviews to whether the ACCC, which is traditionally and still today very much seen as an enforcement agency, should take on to a greater extent than it has already in the past the functions of advocacy, particularly on competition policy, and the function of market studies. What's the international thinking and trends in relation to those functions being performed by competition authority?
This is a tough question. Tough question, because this is a debate which I think is unique to Australia. In other words, the rest of the world goes in a different direction. The rest of the world starts from a different position as well. Australia is very rich, or used to be very rich, and is trying to be very rich again, and can afford to have 2-3 competition authorities. Okay. Now, if you have 2 or 3 competition authorities, how do you allocate the function between them? I understand that there's a question. In most other countries, you only have one competition authority when you have one. So you only have one. In which case, the issue of whether it should be in charge of advocacy or not is not an issue, because it's obvious that if somebody is going to advocate for competition, it's got to be the competition authority. There's no one else there, at least no one who can be trusted. So that there's a difference. So that's why the issue... Second, there are all kinds of reasons that one could think that it's easier to advocate when you have a lot of experience on what's happening on the ground, when you are an enforcer as well, because you know the reality very much better than other people, and because you have thought about those issues. I'm a bit mystified as why, quite aside from the fact that if you have several competition authorities, one can debate, but that's a very specific issue. But at the general level, I have never heard an argument that said that if you're a competition agency, an enforcement agency, and you advocate at the same time, you are going to be biased in your enforcement, and therefore it's not advisable. I can understand, and I've seen example of that, for example, in my home country, in France. We were asked many years ago about whether it was wise to include in the competition law a provision against abuse of dependency. Okay. Basically, we said it doesn't make any sense from the economic point of view. We're not in favor of it. The legislators decided otherwise. And so we now have a provision which is part of the abuse of dominance, but which is abuse of dependency provision. We've never found a case that... So in a sense, we have refused to enforce it because we didn't believe it. So one could say, ah, this is a bias. I mean, this is what happens. When you give an opinion, your opinion is not followed, and then... But my counter-argument is to say, even if we had not been asked whether it was a good idea or not a good idea, I think we would have had the same reason. We don't find that it is economically sound to define the concept of abuse of dependency, and therefore we would have had a lot of difficulty to do it in any case. So I don't think that the behavior, the enforcement behavior of the competition authority was the result of being upset at the fact that its opinion had been followed, but it was consistent with the opinion that it had given because it didn't think that it was a competition issue in the first place. So I have not heard, and I don't know personally, that this issue has been raised elsewhere. I'm not saying that it's never been raised, but I've never heard of this. Now, on market studies, we just held a seminar on market studies in Latin America for Latin American countries, but the EU, the UK, and the countries that do a lot of market studies with it. It would seem to me very strange, a little bit for the same reasons, that the competition agency would not be the, if there's only one, or was this qualification, wouldn't be the agency that does the market studies, because it's tremendously useful to figure out what potentially are the competition problem, potentially what the law, whether the law could apply. Then we can discuss on something which is a particular variety of market studies, which are the market studies that lead to an allow the competition authority to impose remedies, like in the UK, which is quite extreme, and which the EU doesn't have. Okay. So for the same reason that I'm a bit worried about the commitment decisions, I would also be a bit worried about allowing remedies following a market studies without any kind of procedure. But at the same time, I think it's a very useful tool to alert the enforcer to some problems, or to reveal some problems, or even possibly for the enforcers to reveal problems that the enforcer cannot solve because they are not within, but at least to flag them to anything that helps understand competition, I think is theoretically good for the competition enforcement agency.
Well, I agree.